This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Everybody, welcome to PTBN Rewind. This is the monthly spotlight on wrestling shows of the past. Sure, there are lots of other podcasts, even a lot right here on Place to Be Nation that do this, but none quite like we do it. I am your host, Ben Morse. Whether you listen to me on Place to Be Nation's main event, where I appear per my contract every 8 weeks or so, or weekly on This Week in Marvel over on Marvel.com, I'm just happy you found your way here. Today, we've got a great show to discuss. We got a great panel to discuss it. Those are the prerequisites. I'm not going to ramble on for too long because we got a lot to get to, so I'm going to introduce the guys who are joining me. First, a veteran of this show. Both guys veterans of the show tonight, which is nice, but a guy who, one of my favorite podcast hosts in the world right now. I'm going to try to make these guys guess which one of them I'm talking about, but of course I'm talking about History of Wrestling and Wrestling with Optimism, two of my absolute favorite podcasts right now. He also runs historyofwwe.com. He also has a new book that is going to be very pertinent to the show we're covering tonight. Graham Cawthon, you said I could call you whatever I wanted, but I'll just stick with Buddy.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm looking forward to it. It's just so everyone knows for whenever they're listening, it's 11 o'clock at night on a Friday, and we are talking wrestling.
Yeah.
Certain category.
I feel like if we were like 18, that would be a problem. But you know, we're all old enough to know better.
We're all married. We all kind of have lives. We made it.
That's what I hold up as proof every day. I mean, I work at a comic book company. I watch wrestling, and when people give me a hard time, I just show them the ring on my finger, and I say, "Look, I got nothing to prove. Nothing Pop to it. Prove anymore." The other third of this equation, one of the most familiar voices here on PTBN, one of the godfathers of the whole shebang. We all owe him everything, and we will never forget that. A guy I don't get to talk to enough, but I look forward to it every time. He is, let's see if we can get all this right. He is the co-host of the Place to Be podcast, the co-host of the Dangerous Alliance podcast, another great new show you guys should absolutely be listening to, the primary host and producer of the Kevin Kelly Show, not easy to pull off. I think he does Extra Point, some basketball stuff, one of the comics podcasts. Justin Rosero, JT Rosero, what are you going by tonight, and how are you doing?
Extra Point, no. Yes, but all the other stuff is right. I call me Al, Ben. That's good. We're good with that.
Was it a struggle to wait through my long introduction so I could do the sound clip?
My thumb almost went like three or four times, and then you kept going. It was like Pat Patterson at Over the Edge 98, which, you know, I heard a podcast about here on PlaceMediation.com, so you should go check that out if you haven't yet.
you have a spare 4 hours, yeah, it's a good listen. Yeah, man, I just picture you sitting there just like, oh, I have a gag. I have a gag.
Well, the only, I mean, speaking of gags, the only person we're missing is the king of strip clubs, Glenn Butler. I mean, that's, where's he?
You know, gave him the night off. Gave him the night off. Wanted to make this a little more family-friendly, this show.
I was just listening to him and Mark Clare carry Stephen Graham on their back through the ECW Super Vault there.
Yeah, you know, we got the quality Graham. Mm-hmm. So I like to say, are you and Stephen related, Graham?
Only if we get married.
Only because he doesn't know who he is, and that's what makes it even better.
Tremendous. Well, listen, guys, tonight we're going to be talking about King of the Ring 1994 edition. Graham, of course, wrote a book. He's written several books. I haven't gotten any of them in the mail. I'm waiting on those. But the most recent book, Graham, why don't you tell us what your most recent book is about, and we will segue into this show off of that after we cover a little more business.
Well, it is a show-by-show look at the entire pro wrestling history of the Baltimore Arena. And it's an arena that it's very unique in that it is the same structure that has been there since 1962 and has seen countless big events, countless small events, the very rare venues during the 80s and 90s that pretty much could host any wrestling promotion that came through. You didn't see too many venues that could do that. And it's a venue that's still standing. It's a venue that still hosts Raw, so it hosts pay-per-views. And there's just a ton of very unique history behind it. And the book takes a look at literally every show that's ever been held there, every promotion, talks with dozens of fans that were there for big events, small events, talks with talent, backstage people. I think we collected more than 1,300 photos, so it's a pretty fun, in-depth look at that venue in that city.
Yeah, and of course, Baltimore was... What was the show that was just in Baltimore recently? There's been like 8 WWE pay-per-views in the last little bit, but it's still...
Don't tell me to call into main event. Is that what this is?
Yeah, I'm looking down the Wikipedia list. God. No, they just had... Payback in Baltimore, obviously, but you know, we're looking back to 1994, King of the Ring, which was hosted in the Baltimore Arena. We wanted to do a June pay-per-view, we wanted to do a King of the Ring, and we figured, you know, why not help Graham out, help him make a few bucks. So, Graham, how can people get the book and help support all the vices that you have?
We all my cocaine habits. We are still working on the layout because when you're working with 1,300 images and all these stories, it takes a while to play around with that and make it all look good. But we hope to have that out in the next month or so. But you can go ahead and pre-order it. Check out thehistoryofwwe.com. And it's only, I think, $25 plus shipping for U.S. residents. And I'm sorry, foreigners, but your international shipping would kill me.
That's fair. Does Canada count as the U.S.?
Not in this case. if it requires a customs form, I cannot help you at this time.
You're not filling it out. All right. So throughout the show, we will be getting some great Baltimore facts from Graham, as well as his insight into the matches and everything else. Now, what we like to do when we start out any episode of PTBN Rewind is kind of place the principles. Where were we when this show took place? Since Graham just got to talk a little, Justin, let's go over to you. 1994, I know obviously from listening to the PTV podcast, you were quite a wrestling fan. You were at Royal Rumble 1994. Spring of 94, where were you at? What do you remember as far as your fandom and kind of the feelings you were having towards the product at the time?
Super into it. So I was had just finished up with, or was just finishing up 8th grade and graduating, getting ready for high school. But that summer was a great summer for me because it was one where I really had like zero responsibility, you know, a little too young to work, a little too old to, or old enough to kind of be on my own throughout the summer. You know, one of my best friends, Josh Richard, lived across the street. So every morning he'd be over and we'd hang out for most of the day. And we were doing a lot of our kind of, you know, home movie filming and WCF would be starting. And but we were super into wrestling, you know, wrestling figures half the day. And just, you know, I didn't have a vast tape library or anything at that point. So we watched what I had or just waited till the next Saturday. Besides the Rumble, I had just been to a house show right after WrestleMania 10, part of the WrestleMania Revenge Tour. and it was like one of my favorite live events ever. Brett and Owen had a great match, and that was where we found out Diesel had won the Intercontinental title. I hadn't aired yet on Superstars. I think this was like the night before. I mean, it was like the Friday night.
Oh, cool. So he just walked out with the belt.
Yeah, he came out with the belt, and like we were just going awesome. Crazy because we were big Shawn and Diesel fans. Yeah. And we got on TV because they interviewed us on like the local affiliate after the show and in the arena. So we got on, you know, 30F is number one or whatever. So so that was cool. So I had that tape for a long time watching that. And yeah, just really, really into the product, 30F and WCW at this point, just diehard.
Graham, how about over to you? Were you, I know you're a Southern man, but more of a WWF
Southern
guy in 94?
Southern belle, a debutante. Yeah.
You were just out well, of your actually, when you got out of your cotillion, were you going to watch were you going to watch Superstars or Saturday Night?
No, remember I was a military kid, so I wasn't necessarily Southern at the time. So at the time I was actually living in DC.
Oh, okay.
And I made the argument once or twice, "Hey Dad, there's a pay-per-view coming to Baltimore." And it never really went anywhere, so I didn't get to go see the show, but I wanted to. I had never been to Baltimore at that point. But I was watching WWF all the time. I was watching WCW all the time. I think at this point, Slamboree had just taken place a couple weeks mm-hmm. prior, and that was a fun show. That was great arguably show. The last original kind of feeling of WCW before Hogan came in full-time. And I had some knowledge of ECW, but just through the magazines.
Right. It was still Eastern at this point, right? It wasn't Extreme?
Right. That would have been in August.
Right. So we were right on the cusp of that. Yeah, it was an interesting time for wrestling. It was kind of a transition period because Hogan was headed into WCW. You had ECW right about to be on the rise. And meanwhile, the WWF, I think this was, and we'll talk about it. This is one of the things I want to get into because you hear, if you did a drinking game on this show with the words new generation, you would probably be like Graham by the end of the night. So they were forced to really start trusting this young talent that they'd been kind of hedging for the year previous. And we'll get into all of that. The way we're going to structure this show is for this first half, we're going to run through the matches. You guys have heard it before, but we'll get our discussion points in to kind of give you some background on what happened on this show. So the second half, we can really kind of dig into the decisions, the booking, the superstars, a lot of fun stuff. So obviously there are two big draws, arguably three big draws on this show. You've got the King of the Ring tournament, which I think is the centerpiece, the crown jewel, not to be too on the nose of the early King of the Ring pay-per-views. You had a championship match, which was Bret Hart defending against Diesel, who, as Justin said, had just recently won the Intercontinental title. And then you have Roddy Piper coming back from a retirement to take on Jerry Lawler in a grudge match. We're going to touch on all three of those. We're going to run through them now on the tournament, which is where they started out. The first match of the night sees Razor Ramon, who had made it to the finals of the tournament the year before, apologies. That's a spoiler for what's coming. He took on Bam Bam Bigelow, the true guy who made it to the finals the year before. So Razor had been a heel the year before, Bigelow consistent. They have a 8-minute match, which someone enjoyed the match. But I guess we'll talk more about him later. But yeah, this is the opening 8-minute match. Also, the more appropriate clip there would have been that my man Razor, right?
I got so many loaded up, Ben. Yeah,
I was going to say the sound. Business here. Okay, sorry.
Put the just have the whole audio of the pay per view handy, just so I can call up exactly accurate clips. I was trying to have him laugh at your joke. That's all.
We're gonna try to go as far as we can without actually mentioning his name. So okay. We'll see how that goes. But Razor beats Bam Bam in a 8-minute 30-second opening match. It was one of the longer matches of the night. We of course all watched this back recently. I'll tell you guys, I dug this match, and one of the things I really dug about it was watching Razor get to play the little guy, because you're kind of used to, even though Scott Hall's not the biggest guy, he's a large dude. He's generally taking on guys who are smaller than him, and getting to see him work with Bam Bam and kind of get tossed around a little bit was a lot of fun. Graham, what did you think of this match? What were the highlights for you? And what did you think of Razor's performance in particular?
Oh, I thought it was a very fresh matchup. It was something that we had seen before. Bam Bam was just coming off the feud with Doink and was getting some matches with Brett for the title at that point. And Razor was just kind of rebounding from losing the IC title. I loved the match on paper. I thought, you know, the only downside is I could see either of them going all the way through the tournament. I hate it's an opening round match.
But kind of the strength of that is you get two bigger names out there for the opening match. Like, we'll talk about some of the other first round matches. It would have been kind of tough to put them in the opening slot. Like, you want to have two names out there for the first match of the show. It's kind of my take there.
I get that, but you could structure the tournament accordingly.
That's true. That's a good point. Justin, what do you think of that? And I also know you're a Bam Bam guy. So what did you think of him going out so quick?
I agree with Graham, and we'll talk in a minute how I think they could have done it.
Sure.
But I liked this match a lot. I thought they had really good chemistry together. I was just happy to see Bigelow finally kind of get past the Doink feud that he had been really in since like August or so, September rather, when Doink had turned face. But yeah, I like this. I thought the finish was really good when Razor hits the powerbomb off the top rope for the win. I thought that was a good finish. The crowd was really into it. Bigelow had a couple good submission attempts with the hanging backbreaker, and they broke out some different offense, which is really cool to see. And this is kind of the end of Bigelow's run with Luna too, because by our next show he's with the Corporation. So it's kind of like the end of an era a little bit for Bigelow that he's been in since the King of the Ring previous is when Luna hooked up with him. So kind of brings this year of his life to a close. But yeah, I like this match a lot. Razor winning was not a surprise.
Yeah. Definitely, Razor was in, you know, kind of the heart of where he's intended for big things. The IC belt is off of him. Got to keep him hot. As we move forward, he has a confrontation backstage with IRS, who also has a confrontation with Mabel. I don't have notes right in front of me, so I'm pretty sure I messed up the order of those. But there's a lot of confrontations with IRS going on backstage. Erwin Unscheister at this point kind of feels to me like he's past his due date, although I always like watching him in the ring. The character, as they're moving into this new generation, to me, starts feeling like a guy who maybe doesn't fit quite as much. And I'm not saying that because, you know, he had the Taxman gimmick or anything like that. Just didn't quite jive with. I didn't see him as a credible threat to the Razors and the Bretts of the world. He goes out there and has a match with Mabel, who this is really his first tease at a singles push. He ends up, IRS takes the win, gets a little roll up in 5 minutes. JR, what did you think of Mabel at this point? Did you think he could be a solo guy? And what was your take on IRS and this match for that matter?
I could see rewatching these now as we're going through them. I can kind of see maybe what they were thinking. But I always thought he had such a weird body shape. And it's not just that he's fat. It's just that he's so tall and fat. But he has like really kind of skinny legs.
Yeah.
And like, and that purple baggy outfit didn't help him. So he doesn't look like a guy that jumps out at you is like, oh, this guy could maybe be a solo star at this point. So it was always kind of surprising to me that they went that way. IRS, and I don't want to recycle material too much here off other podcasts, but on the Dangerous Alliance podcast, we talked a little bit about Mike Rotunda, and I compared him to the girl that you see that, you know, you're not sure if she's hot. You know, she's supposed to be hot, but you're not sure if you actually find her hot. And to me, that's Rotunda. Like I hear about him and I see him and I'm like, I'm supposed to like Mike Rotunda. And then I watch him and I'm like, do I like Mike Rotunda? And it's just, I go in this circle with him. And I don't know if he was quite done yet, because I think maybe he would have been if they didn't have the Corporation to kind of resuscitate him, because I think that was a good landing spot for him. Without that, he might have been in some trouble. But these are the two matches I would have flipped. To Graham's point, I would have done Razor IRS in the first round, and then Bigelow Mabel in the second, because that at least adds a little bit of question to the next round. Like,
interesting.
Oh yeah,
there was zero chance IRS was going to the finals, right? So I mean, this pretty much makes the next round really obvious. But Bigelow is at least believable if you have that be your first semifinal match that he could advance. So I think that's the first thing I would mix up here. I'd have Bigelow over Mabel. And they had, and Graham, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they had some matches too on TV or a house show. Like, they had a little feud, Bigelow and Mabel. It might have been after this.
It was after, and I think they kind of tied in a little bit with Survivor Series as well.
Okay, yeah, I knew it was around sometime in 94 they had a little bit of a feud. So maybe that starts here, and then you have Razor finish off IRS to kind of bury their feud. in the first round. The match is nothing, and the finish just is awful, where Mabel just like falls off the rope and IRS kind of just lays next to him and pins him. But I mean, Mabel actually controlled a lot of the match, which is surprising, but to me the finish is what really just buries it. I would have just done like a count out or something here. It would look better than the way IRS just laid next to Mabel and kind of picked his leg up.
Yeah. That definitely fulfills my what I wanted too, where I said you got to have an opening match with two names. I mean, sure, like Razor and IRS already had the history from the Rumble. It's not a bad switch, and I would have been interested to see Bigelow and Mabel. I would have missed the Razor Bigelow match because on the rewatch, I was surprised how much I liked that. But
well, no, I would just have that in the second round.
True.
You can do the same exact match, Benjamin. Just have exactly the same. Just round two.
You have thought this out, sir.
Well, I just did a whole podcast on rebooking King of the Rings.
I was going to say, you're so pre-gamed this. You're so ready for this. You can just recycle that.
I've recycled a lot so far tonight.
Yeah. Graham, what did you think of this match? What did you're a guy who maybe knows Rotundo's career a little better. I mean, obviously, at this point, we all know Rotundo's career. But at the time, as someone who, you know, was bouncing around, what did you think of him?
Well, I made some notes before the show, and my note regarding IRS
what?
Is, yeah, and my note regarding IRS is heatless.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I hear just recently, to go back even further on his career, like in 87 when he's working for Crockett, that he's a babyface, but he's heatless, and yeah. Kevin Sullivan actually makes fun of it, and that kind of helps lead into the Varsity Club. He comes in and says, what are you doing? What is this? This is garbage. you're beating nobodies. No one cares about it.
Yeah. I remember watching that on 24/7 and I was like, wow, that's some heady stuff for 87.
This is about the same time they could make the same argument for him as a heel.
Yeah. We'll come back to him because Justin, your hot girl that you're supposed to think is hot analogy is perhaps the greatest Mike Rotundo analogy I've ever heard. And I look forward to hearing it expanded upon on the Dangerous Alliance podcast, which I have breaking the fourth wall again, have not listened to yet, but that sounds like a great discussion point, and I can't wait to hear what Will has to say about it.
Who's the guy in the white suit? Guy in the white suit?
That'd be Oscar.
That's Oscar, the manager of Men on a Mission, huh? Oh, I thought maybe he was the guy coming to take him to the hospital.
You know, I appreciate Art bringing up Oscar because I knew we weren't going to get a chance to talk about him, so it's glad that someone gave Oscar his props.
Oscar, was, yeah. I'm telling you, rewatching these, like, I feel like the pieces are there for Men on a Mission, but mm-hmm. there's like a few things that are just off because I kind of didn't maybe appreciate at the time, like, how over, like, the rap was in the beginning. Like, the beat under the rap is pretty catchy, and the crowds go pretty crazy for them when they come out. Like, they really get into the rapping, even though Oscar mm-hmm. kind of sucks at it. And, like, they all have, like, one deficiency. Like, Mabel, or the overall is the purple tights, right? I mean, that's so stupid.
Yeah.
And Mabel's body type is his deficiency. To me, Mo, for whatever reason, went with the dyed white hair, and it makes him look, like, really old.
Oh, yeah.
I always thought he was, like, in his, like, 60s or something. You know,
it's like, I thought it was Mabel's dad.
Right? Yeah. Like, it's an odd choice. Because then when he dyes it, he goes to the black when they turn. And, you know, he looks young. So it's like, why would you purposely make yourself look older? And then, and Oscar is just a bad rapper. But I feel like the chess pieces were on the board. They just didn't know how to arrange them, you know?
Oh, I think you're right. I think the Men on a Mission gimmick, the, like, framework is there. But, one, it's Vince McMahon trying to do it, or whoever was trying to do it in 94 because he was going through the steroid stuff. But you're right. I think you move Men on a Mission to 97, maybe have better workers or at least, you know, jacked guys going with the rap gimmick. Yeah, it absolutely could have worked. And it's just little things here and there. You're right. Like, change the color of the hair, change the color of the tights. Men on a Mission could have been they could have had a few more. They definitely could have had a longer run than they did.
Look. Around the world on everybody's boat. It almost knocked the hole right through the bottom of the boat.
Yeah, maybe that's, you know, you guys went in your first Dangerous Alliance booking what Savage should have been doing. Maybe the role he was meant for was Oscar's role, you know?
Well, we'd learn later what a good rapper he was.
Absolutely. You get mileage out of being Oscar for a couple years. Mm. Do the Hogan Be a Man rap in 94. I think that's money right there.
Yeah.
Here's the thing with Men on Mission and Mabel. Okay, so you look at 93. Mm. Who are the big rappers? Snoop Doggy Dogg, Dr. Dre, and then you take that and boil it down for the WWF, and you basically get a giant guy who looks like Barney.
I thought he looked like an eggplant, getting back to his body shape. Better King Hippo.
It's the leg. He's so tall. Like, he'd either look good as if he was shorter and fatter or taller and thinner. But the tall, fat thing, just, I don't know. It's just a weird look. And the mohawk, I don't know. Just, it's just a whole odd overall presentation.
Yeah. So we hope you guys are enjoying this Men on a Mission retrospective podcast.
I want a whole Exile on Bad Street Men on a Mission for like 5 hours.
I would sleep through that, yes.
Did you say I would sleep through that?
I would sit through that.
I know what you said, Graham. All right, moving on to the next match. Another 8-minute match, and this is where we start to see one of our shining stars of the tournament, a guy we're going to talk about a lot, Owen Hart, who was coming off his WrestleMania win over his brother Brett, taking on Tatanka, who at this point defeated, not undefeated, but still kept very strong. Tatanka did not lose a lot. So this is a good competitive match for Owen. It was a chance for him to start showing his stuff, which is a discussion I want to get into in the second half of this. But for the purpose of the match, what did you guys think of Owen, who's still kind of, you know, an emerging star here? Graham, how did you think he did in this first round? Obviously, having to go out there and have one of the longer matches of the night and kind of prove that he can hang with a guy like Tatanka, who has been the beneficiary of a pretty decent push from WWF for a couple of years at this point.
Well, I remember watching it live, and Tatanka got a little bit of a story going into the tournament, too, because he had to wrestle Crush twice, and then Luger helped win it the second time. So there was, you know, a little bit more tournament backstory with Tatanka than there was with Owen. And so it was, in my mind, because it's not super, super obvious at that point, I kind of see it as a toss-up. Mm. And so when Owen actually wins, and the way that he wins, and he just, like, outsmarts Tatanka in a straight-up wrestling match, you kind of have to go, well, there's your odds-on guy.
Yeah. JR, what did Owen show you in this match? Because I think he's really the guy we're going to start digging into here, because a lot of this, the theme of this night is really Owen Hart proving that, you know, even all the momentum he had from the Rumble to WrestleMania, he's still less than a year removed from being, you know, basically one half of High Energy. He's still trying to prove himself as a bona fide singles. How much do you think getting a good solid win over Tatanka helped? And was Owen an underdog given his lesser weight to Tatanka?
Well, I don't know how much they weigh. Yeah, because it's funny, at the time, for someone that was so into the product and fairly in tune, you know, Owen was having such a big year, I still, in my little predictions, picked Tatanka to win this match because I thought him and Jarrett was going to be the matchup in the second round. And maybe that was more indictment on Jarrett's opponent than anything else. But
yeah,
so I think it was a bit of an upset in some ways, but I just wasn't really, you know, I was just tone deaf to the fact that they were having Owen just kind of rework Brett's, you know, like, you know, career line. But they, I agree with Graham. I think the way they had him win was really good, because that was starting to kind of become his calling card now. Like, we saw it in Mania with Brett, where, you know, Brett was dominating towards the end, and Owen kind of slips in and kind of steals the win. And he does it here, too. He hangs around, and then grabs the win when it seems like he's most in danger. So that's kind of becoming his thing. So I like that they did it again here. And, you know, I'm not going to blame them at all for having Tatanka lose to Ludwig Borga, because they had big things planned for Borga. But imagine what this win could have meant for Owen if he ended Tatanka's streak in the tournament to open the show, like, you know, to open the first round. Like, that would have been really cool. But I mean, that's just complete hindsight. There's no way of knowing that was
sure
that Borga was going to go down so quick.
It also would it have meant less if it's like packed into the middle of the tournament, or do you think that's really impactful?
It was early enough in the show. Mm-hmm. And I think with the way they, you know, they were really good at this point at making stuff important if it needed to be. So
absolutely,
I think they really would have hyped it. And I know we'll talk about the commentary later, but, like, I really dug Savage on the
show.
I really dug Savage on the show, and I think he would have sold it properly.
Absolutely.
So, and they could have played up last year even, where Tatanka and Luger went to the draw. So, you know, could Tatanka keep a streak going, or will it finally end here tonight? You know, we're guaranteed to either have it end or him win the crown, maybe. So, there was no way they could have known, but that would have been just a cool touch that could have maybe propped
the match. You could have opened the show with that.
Right. Yeah, exactly. The Tatanka's undefeated streak on the line, opening the show.
You made a good point, too, about Owen, that he was a different type of heel for WWF, because, you know, the WWF formula had always been the monster heels. Even when you had a smaller guy, it was a Savage or an Orndorff, a guy who still was pretty physically impressive, even, you know, going all the way down to guys like Flair. Like, Flair still seemed like a normal-sized guy. Owen was small. He was a cruiserweight, basically. So he needed to have a thing that made him an effective heel. And what you said was right there, JR. It's that he's the guy who has the ability and just kind of the won't quit attitude to stick around until he finds the banana peel, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, he's not going to maul you. He is just going to find a sneaky way out, which is great, because it was what WWF needed at the time as they're trying to transition away from being Land of the Giants. And it's also a guy who could really aggravate you. And it fed into that whole, like, you know, annoying little brother character. He's always there, and eventually you're gonna miss him.
Yep.
Yeah. So you talked about Jarrett thinking he was gonna go the next round. He doesn't. He loses to the 1-2-3 Kid in the first of Kid's really showcase matches for this night. I got a lot to talk about with the 1-2-3 Kid once we come back from the break. But here, just a really great fast paced match with Kid and Jarrett, and he does pull off the upset, you know, his specialty. He beats Jarrett. The crazy thing to me is this match was only 4 minutes.
Right.
It was 4:40. They pack a lot in there. Were you impressed by that, Justin?
Yeah, and then the post-match goes another few minutes. But yeah, the match itself I thought was pretty good. And this has one of my favorite art lines. I don't have the quote here, but he calls Double J a cutie for some reason. That was always stuck out with me.
I mean, the blonde hair, the suspenders.
I guess
so.
Yeah, I guess he's a cutie. I thought it was well worked. They really played up that Jarrett was very arrogant throughout it. So every time he'd kind of get a little arrogance, Kid would land a shot, and then Jarrett would steady the ship and hit another move, and he'd get cocky again. And then finally it caught up to him, and Kid steals the win. But I really like the post-match here with the three stiff pile drivers by Jarrett.
Yeah.
Really one of the best things he's done since his debut, because he hadn't done much. You know, his biggest thing to date was probably, being part of, you know, killing the Undertaker at the Royal Rumble.
Not to be overlooked, yeah.
Right. So to me, that was probably his biggest thing so far. I don't know if he had even done the doink thing yet, Graham. Do you know, had he done that where we had the doink paint on and he beat up Dink? That might have happened, but
yeah, it was right around that time.
Yeah. So nothing major. So this was kind of like his first, okay, I'm here. I'm not a goof, and I'm just going to destroy the 1-2-3 Kid by breaking his neck with pile drivers. So I liked that part of it, and it set up a nice story for the Kid going on.
Graham, what did you think about that, putting an injury angle into the early part of the show? It definitely adds more story to the tournament, which I think what you need. Like in the 93 one, you had the fact that Bigelow got the rest while Brett didn't. Did you think this tournament needed something like this?
It helped, and especially you gave it to the guy who's already an underdog. So it just creates more sympathy heat for the 1-2-3 Kid. And it was interesting watching the show live, and you see Owen Hart in our minds get an upset win over Tatanka, and then the very next match, well, the babyface gets an upset win, so that we get a heel babyface match, because we can't have heels versus heels and babyfaces versus babyface.
Yeah, no, that would be unheard of, and I don't know how they would make that work. So we've got our final four for the King of the Ring tournament here. Razor Ramon, Erwin R. Scheister, Owen Hart, 1-2-3 Kid. We take a break from the tournament, and this is kind of, it was neat. It was almost like a house show, because they had almost like a mid-card main event. It was like if you go to an afternoon house show. And that was, as we mentioned before, you had Bret Hart, WWF champion, won it back at WrestleMania. So his first major pay-per-view title defense against Diesel, who was a really interesting character here in the sense that transitioning from being Shawn Michaels' bodyguard to being a legitimate competitor. A lot of that had to do with his Royal Rumble performance that JR was there live for. But he'd been building up. Shawn had the great ladder match with Razor at WrestleMania 10, now stepping back a little, becoming the manager role of Diesel. Diesel had just won the Intercontinental title, so this is champion versus champion. Bret's big thing before the match is teasing he's going to have someone in his corner. It's going to be a family member. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't have clear memories of the time. Graham or Justin, if you do, was there speculation of like who it could be outside of Anvil, who it ends up being Jimmy Anvil Ninefart, his brother-in-law?
I wanted Bulldog.
Yeah, me too.
I absolutely wanted Bulldog.
I kind of figure like that was the obvious choice, right? Were a lot of people at the time thinking like, oh, this is just going to be Bulldog? And then to both of you guys, were you disappointed when Anvil came out? Because I remember I was excited just because Anvil to me was so left field. Mm. Like I was just like, oh, he won't be the guy to come back. Like I didn't even think of him. Justin, what was your reaction when Anvil comes out behind Brett?
Yeah, I was surprised and I was fine with it. I was hoping for Bulldog too, but not really expecting mm-hmm. it. So it wasn't like I was disappointed. Honestly, I really thought it was going to be Stu, I remember as a kid, because the way they were kind of prepping it, and I figured, oh, Brett will have his dad in his corner, because, you know, he had been out there before Survivor Series, he was in the corner of the family and everything, so I thought it would be just be something like that, or even like Bruce, someone who had been on, so Neidhart caught me off guard. Now, going back and kind of like rereading some of the stuff from like RSPW and, you know, Herb Coons and his news and notes, it seems like it was actually pretty well known that it was going to be Neidhart. I guess it was like really obvious, but not to me anyway. Grant,
right, yeah,
did
I
you
mean,
have
we
any
kids.
Clue it was Neidhart? I know you said you wanted Bulldog, but was it on your radar at all?
No. I did not have the interwebs back in 1994.
Yeah, right.
But I remember, because I was a huge Bulldog fan, and he walked out, or he left, quit, fired from WCW in December.
Right.
And so we hadn't seen him. But the way the story plays out, where he can, you know, he does eventually is pulled into this.
How long after this does he come back? Because it's only
SummerSlam is his return. Yeah.
Oh, really? He's not on camera for SummerSlam?
No, he's in the crowd at SummerSlam.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. When they do the live countdown show, Savage comes out and is like, "Here's the Hart family. Oh, here's the British Bulldog too."
Which is kind of funny in the sense that it's like, yeah, the British Bulldog sitting in the crowd like an audience member taking a day off from his job, which is, wait, being a
right.
wrestler.
Doing steroids.
Yeah. Just sitting on. Where's he
enlarging his heart. This is his day job.
Oh, too soon.
The, it pays enough to get Roger Morissette's power back on, maybe. Another little fun fact here, by the way, is Bret Hart's theme music debuts here. So up until this point, he had still been using the old like Hart Foundation theme. So kind of full circle that Anvil returns right when Bret kind of finally retires that, you know, their old school theme song. And this is where he gets
that
the one
really
that's
neat.
The one there where he gets his, you know, his most well-known version from here.
Yeah.
So.
Wow, that's really neat. 22 minutes this match goes, actually nearly 23 minutes, far and away the longest match on the card. And these guys are good. I mean, Diesel, this is really... Yeah, this is kind of they would end up having basically a trilogy. They'd have this, they'd have Rumble 95. What was their four? Oh yeah, they'd have a cage match too.
Yeah,
a quadrilogy. And I'm sure they wrestled at some point in WCW on, you know, in addition to Thunder, to really put a capper on it. But yeah, these guys had great chemistry. Why was that? And this the interesting thing here is, you know, Diesel's very he's still green at this point. He's still coming out of his shell, but I feel like Brett had a lot to do with the progression of Diesel. You like you said, you're a big Diesel guy, JR. Did you recognize as a kid that, oh wow, he's having a better match than he usually does, or was it just like, oh cool, Diesel?
Yeah, I had my Diesel blinders on, so I just I thought he was good. But no, I really liked the match then, and when I just rewatched it a few weeks ago, I loved it even more. And it's a great point, Ben, about how, you know, Brett's kind of, he's almost like his pace car throughout his career. Like he checks in at every stage. Like he has a match with him here as Diesel's get
good
going.
Yeah.
Then Diesel hits his peak, wins a title, and they have a match at the Rumble. All right, kid, you're coming along. Then Diesel has his reign, kind of comes back down the mountain. Brett checks him again, and then they have their final match. So he's kind of been there the whole time, and he kind of has these matches and throughout his run. But yeah, the match itself is really good, and it's like a big time fight. And even Savage kind of calls that out too, because they have these points where, like, Diesel's just out on his feet, but he's not falling. Brett's just hammering him with right hands, and then Diesel would kind of, you know, gain his bearings back and land a big move, and just a lot of that back and forth. And I loved Sean at ringside in this match.
Sean
I thought he
was great,
just pinballing all around, nonstop energy outside. Him and Anvil get into a you know a chase at one point. And then just like when it looks like Diesel has the match won, hits the jackknife, Neidhart comes in, draws a DQ. And I want your guys' take on this, because this is something Chad had mentioned when we did the Brad and Chad King of the Ring show. He said he thought this match made Brett look weak as champion. I disagreed, because I didn't, and even rewatching it now, I don't think he did. And Diesel was being propped as such a monster that I don't think it was like the worst thing in the world that Diesel almost had him beat. And I thought Brett looked so good in the match that I didn't get that vibe at all. Graham, did you?
I mean, it does, but from my perspective watching it as a kid, Diesel had no credibility coming in as a challenger. Because what had he done to that point? He had a decent run in the Rumble.
It was more than decent. Then, that was one of the best runs to date. Like, now it looks decent, but I think at the time we hadn't really had a guy do that, I feel like.
True.
Right, but in the grand scheme of the match, it didn't matter.
And also, how does that translate over necessarily to him being like, he's a legitimate singles guy? You know, he threw a lot of guys out in a battle royal, and I agree. That ignited him, Justin. But I get what Graham's saying.
I think beating Razor Ramon.
Right, but that had just happened.
Yeah.
Well, it was April.
Right, but like, okay, like 3 weeks after that happens, now he has a world title match announced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It would be like a modern equivalent would be, all right, Rusev beats Sheamus for the U.S. title and gets a world title match the next pay-per-view.
Yeah, I think we would have been into it.
Like,
I don't know.
Yeah. That's very much a meteoric, like, do we really expect him to win the world title in his first shot?
Well, no, but I think that was part of the story. So, I mean, maybe you don't expect it, but all of a sudden you're like, well, this guy's hot, he's on a roll. And they almost made it like, the way they did it was like, he was just kind of held back as a bodyguard, because he didn't really have a lot of matches until, you know, even on TV until like late in the fall when, you know, Sean left. And they almost made it like the shackles kind of came off, and that Sean in his corner flipping the script and having him kind of be the advisor, almost that was like the tipping point to get Diesel the confidence he needed to get going. I don't know. That's the way I remember it being.
Yeah, I think this match is great for Diesel. Does it make Brett look weak? Yeah, but the match isn't about Brett, really. It's in the grand scheme of the story, it's not about Brett. And I think this match does a lot to make Diesel super, super, super hot going into SummerSlam.
See, here's why I'll argue that I don't think the match makes Brett look weak. And I think it has to do with Brett's character and taking more of a global view of Brett's character. Again, we're coming out of the era of the Hulk Hogan, of the aborted Lex Luger, the kind of superhero babyface who just goes in there, maybe gets beat up a little bit. You know, Hogan would get beat up for a little bit, but he would come back with a just heroic comeback. Bret Hart was a different kind of babyface champion, the same way we were just talking about Owen Hart being a different kind of heel. Bret was a guy who would get in there, get beaten up by guys who were bigger than him, stronger than him, more willing to cheat, but kind of as a mirror to his brother, he was never out, you know? He never quit. And the reason I don't think this making him look weak is because, could Diesel have beat him? No, we'll never know, because the whole thing with Bret Hart is, when you think you have him beat, he comes back. He finds a way. He's smart. He finds his way out of it. So that's why I didn't think this match made Bret look weak. I think it made Bret look like Bret. That's the kind of champion he is. Which I think is also interesting, just as I think it's WWF conditioning us to deal with a new kind of champion. You no longer have the formulaic, he's going to get beat up for a certain portion of the match and then make the Superman comeback thing. You now have a guy who is going to win with a roll-up once in a while, or who's going to get his foot on the rope. And that was typically a heel thing before this. So I think it's one of the things that makes this show and this era so interesting. It's WWF almost being forced, kicking and screaming, to get out of Vince's comfort zone and start, you know, you got to start accepting new characters. Which is why I think this was a good match, because Diesel was the prototypical Hogan-era heel, and you saw how Bret Hart deals with him contrasted to how Hulk Hogan deals with him.
Right, and the way go ahead, Graham.
I was just going to say, I think the match is really designed to do two things. One, is designed to give Diesel credibility, and two, it's designed to further the Bret Owen story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely, yeah.
And that's it's designed to do.
And as the match goes, that's what I think where Diesel's credibility, and to your point, Graham, it comes with it. It's like, the match starts, and you're like, all right, Diesel kind of has nothing to lose, right? He's the IC champ. His title, I think they even say on commentary, his title's not on the line. He's got nothing to lose.
They make a point.
Young guy, he'll be here for, you know, this is like, it's like an upstart baseball team, whatever. They somehow make it to the playoffs. So, you know, nothing to lose, all right? So you're out there, you're in there with the champ. And as the match goes on, you know, he's taking these blows. He's taking the champ's best shots. His guy, his manager's one of the best active ringside. And you almost feel the confidence growing. And then he hits his finisher, and everyone's like, oh, my God, could he actually do it? And then we'd ever find out, like Ben said. And I think it doesn't only set the stage for Diesel to continue to grow, and it also sets the stage for an eventual rematch down the line where Diesel could say, look, I had you beat. You know, let's do it again, and we'll eventually get there, but.
We'll talk more about Brett and Diesel as we go. We're going to keep rolling on with the card here, and we'll come back to them. We dive back into the tournament after this.
One of the wrestlers is one of the best. It looks like bring on down, Mabel. Let's see what you got, because you're going to pay IRS. He looks like a businessman.
How about Savage putting over IRS there? One of the best.
One of the best.
Wow.
Well, yeah. The roster's getting a little thin, you know.
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
He's arguably one of the best wrestlers they had at that point.
You got to take what you can get. So our friend Irwin goes up against Razor in, as we noted, a rematch from the 94 Royal Rumble. It's only 5 minutes long. Razor beats him pretty handily. I don't want to spend too much time on this match because, frankly, I don't have that much to say about it.
I thought it was the worst on the card, and that includes the main event to me. Anyway.
So you thought? Did you think Razor Irwin was worse than Mabel Irwin?
I mean no, but and it's better than the main event too. But
yeah,
I think it's it had the best expectations. It had more expectations than IRS Mabel. You know what I mean? Like sure. IRS Mabel, yeah, you kind of expect it to suck. Yeah. This you expect to at least be decent because they just had a decent match at the Rumble. But it is just, you know, as blah as blah gets. I mean IRS. Goes to the chin lock, goes to the abdominal stretch. You get the, you know, the usual Razor. Actually, that was in the main event where you had the worst move ever when he always tries to raise the edge of the ropes. But
I actually had a note down about that. If there's one thing I hate, it's when he sets up for that. You know he's not going to hit it, like the most telegraphed thing. But yeah, we could go on about that.
Just real paint by numbers here. Just bland, boring. The only good thing was that he hits the raises. The only thing I liked is that he actually hit his finisher to kind of reestablish it because he didn't use it in the opener. That's all.
Yeah, Graham Cawthon, can you defend Mike Rotunda here? I don't know why I've painted you into a corner as like the great defender of Mike Rotunda, but I'm going to run. Yeah, I'm going to run with it. Do you have a way to redeem this match, or should we move on?
He's an amazing sweater.
That's true. He sweats like nobody's business. And he can wear a great sweater.
Bell rings and he floods.
It's true. By the time he gets out there, it's even more. The interesting thing is when he's wearing his full IRS attire, I think he doesn't sweat as much as he does in a singlet or in trunks. He sweats even more. It's impressive. He's definitely.
It really is. To count the number of matches where you can visualize him putting someone in a headlock as sweat is dripping off his nose.
I think that I'd rather have him sweating through something. It's the headlock that gets me because he always does the freaking headlock, the chin lock, the abdominal stretch. Just a guy that, again, I mean, technically sound, you know, really good. We're supposed to like it. And just you watch him, you're like, ugh. I guess sit through another IRS match, you know, it's like, you know what you're going to get, you know, 8 to 10 minutes, paint by numbers. He's going to hit all the checkpoints, but at the end of the day, you watch an abdominal stretch and a chin lock and then some kind of finish.
I will say as a former amateur wrestler, which Mike Rotunda was as well, you got to admire the sweating though, the ability to cut weight, even as he's going, that's why he's one of the best guys we got. As no less than Macho Man Randy Savage proclaimed. Next match, lot better. Owen Hart waiting in the ring. 1-2-3 kid. They play his music a couple times. We don't think he's going to come out after those pile drivers. He does come out. And these guys have... This is the most incredible thing. I was amazed by 1-2-3 kid's match with Jeff Jarrett that it was only 4 minutes and 40 seconds. This match between Owen and the 1-2-3 kid is only 3.5 minutes long. But it may be the best 3.5 minute long match you will ever see. Just incredible, just flying around, kid doing crazy aerial maneuvers, Owen trying to take him down, and the finish with the kid getting control for a second, Owen using a power bomb into the sharpshooter, which is always a great combo, and then getting the kid to submit, which meant a lot because we've just basically, great storytelling here, we've seen that the 1-2-3 kid can get beat up by Jeff Jarrett, get hit by three pile drivers, and he won't quit, but Owen can make him quit with his finishing move, which I thought was fantastic. Graham, what did you think of this match, just as a clinic of how to do a quick match?
Well, it was a great match, but then it also reminded us to hate Owen with all of our power and passion, because here's this courageous 1-2-3 kid who just got his ass handed to him, and he hobbles out to the ring, and I remember I think earlier after the attack, Macho Man even says, if the kid even comes out, this arena is going to explode.
Yeah, they were definitely telegraphing a bye, because we've had that in a lot of, you know, many of the tournaments beforehand. So it really seemed like they're setting up just to have Owen pass through.
Mm-hmm. Right. So just the fact that he comes out, they play that up, and then he puts on a competitive. I think of it as the most competitive squash match of all time.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. It's a really good way to put it.
It's very one-sided. I mean, kid gets hope spots, don't get me wrong. But, you know, Owen jumps on him from, you know, before he even gets in the ring. So it's a great clinic. It's very fun. It's very fast-paced. They ended up, I think, back in August, right before SummerSlam, they had a feature match on Raw. Mm-hmm. It probably went a good 15 minutes, but it wasn't, in my opinion, nearly as fun as this.
No, I agree. Right? It was good, but not this good, yeah.
Well, there's an art to this, you know? I think I said it art. On...
Art Donovan?
I can't believe the whole thing!
If you were keeping track, I think we made it roughly 40 minutes into the show before Graham said his full name in Beetlejuice-like fashion, summoning him. No, there's an art to doing a short match and making it good. I think I talked about this in the past. When you only have 3 minutes to go out there, mm-hmm. and on a show like this, a tournament, where you have all these matches stacked on top of one another, that's something you need to go out there and do. I mean, would you agree, Justin, that there's a certain challenge to being able to do something in 3 minutes, as opposed to guys being given, you know, like, yeah, you have 15 minutes, you know, paint a picture. Yeah, you can tell a story a lot easier there.
Yeah, I agree. And, I mean, Owen's dropkick as kid's coming into the ring kind of sets the tone for the whole thing. Yeah. Just crushes him with a baseball slide dropkick. And like Graham said, it just makes you hate him all over again. And mm-hmm. then just dives into him. And then Kid made more comebacks than I remembered, but Owen just, you know, pasted him every time. We get a Northern Lights suplex, we get a belly-to-belly suplex, a German suplex, so just like everything, Owen's just emptying his playbook, trying to end this thing as quickly as possible. And it looked like Kid may actually steal the match, and that's what I love about it, because right at the end, Kid comes back and kind of pushes the pace, and it makes it like, oh my god, Owen has this golden opportunity on a platter. He's got this banged-up 1-2-3 kid. He immediately, again, to use a baseball analogy, you kind of get a lesser team advances in the playoffs. You get this one game, and you score like 6 runs of the first inning. You're like, oh, this is going to be a walk, you know, we're going to walk in the park. And then all of a sudden, the team scores 5 more, and they're kind of hanging in with you, and you're like, oh, we can't blow this opportunity. And that's what it felt like to me. It's like, you know, can Owen just take care of business here against a banged-up lesser opponent? And that was the story in 3.5 minutes. And I like that Owen, similar to Razor, one with his finisher here to kind of reestablish the move after the first round not using it. So we get both finishers in the second round, and then Kid taps quick. But, you know, I love that Owen was a step ahead, averts the bad loss, and moves to the finals, because it means so much to him at this point.
Yeah, and so we got our final setup. It's going to be Razor Ramon against Owen Hart. But before that...
And one last thing of credit, too.
Sure.
This match was even, you know, great as well, because the winner was obvious. Once Razor won, you knew they weren't going to do Razor Kid in the final. So you knew Owen was winning. And the fact that they put together such an awesome match with so many cool little hope spots for the kid, and they have such a sprint in 3.5 minutes, makes it okay that we knew Owen was going to win anyway. Like, they give you just enough doubt in the way they tell the story.
It's incredible that a 3.5 minute match where, like you said, the winner was pretty much, you knew who it was going to be going in, on a show where we already saw that great 22-minute Bret Diesel match. This could still potentially be the match of the night. Mm-hmm. It may have been my favorite match of the night. It probably was.
Yeah, I think so. And you know, he's not with us because of his power issues, but the Cowboy did say it was his match of the night. So,
oh, there you go. Quite an endorsement. That's almost as good as Savage calling IRS one of the greatest wrestlers of his generation. So before the finals, because now we know who's in the finals, essentially to give Owen a break, because, you know, even though he just had that 3 minutes, it was the energy level of about a 20-minute match. We get a tag team title match, tag team title defense by the Head Shrinkers, newly face turned, mm-hmm. newly champs. When did they win it from the Quebecers? It was obviously between WrestleMania and here.
May 2nd, Raw.
Right. So they haven't been the champs for that long. They're getting challenged by Yokozuna and Crush. Interesting team in that Yokozuna is not far removed from being basically the guy who ran roughshod over the entire promotion. Crush still a force to be reckoned with. I like this match a lot more than I thought I was going to, and I really was impressed by the Head Shrinkers, who get a successful defense due to a lot of shenanigans. Lex Luger comes out. He was absent from the show otherwise. He distracts Crush because they were having kind of a dead feud that didn't go anywhere. And they distract him long enough that Fatu is able to get in there and pin Crush. But what did you guys think of the Head Shrinkers here? Because they would not last much longer. Samu would be gone within a couple months. They would not hold the tag titles for very long. I guess I was watching it, and this is, you know, it's an obvious comparison, but I was kind of watching it and I was like, oh man, that's what the Usos are now. The Usos are the Head Shrinkers fully realized as this great babyface team who you enjoy seeing, and they have, you know, good fire, good stuff like that. Justin, did you think there was it too little too late for the Head Shrinkers, or were they never really destined to be kings of the tag team division?
No, yeah, I mean, I think they overshot where they were. I don't think it was too little too late at all. Mm. I definitely think it was a bit of a surprise, because they had shown no indication that they were going to suddenly turn face and become the dominant team. You know, we talk about Diesel coming out of nowhere. I thought the Head Shrinkers were even more so, because they had really not done much. And then you throw, you know, that Glory Hog, Gold Digger, and Lou Albano into the mix. And
I wasn't going to bring him up, but yeah.
You know, him and him and Alpha lead him to the titles. And I was not happy at the time, because diehard Quebecer mark. So,
yes,
you know, they ran them out of the promotion, basically. They beat him on the countdown to the crowning in the rematch, and that was it. So I wasn't happy, but I came around. And I kind of liked them I thought they did a nice job making them feel like a big deal. And even though they lose the titles before SummerSlam, I just watched SummerSlam 94, and they come out with this, like, these big headdresses on. And mm-hmm. they really tried their best to make them stand out as like, a big... this title reign almost makes them kind of made. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. all right, these guys are a big-time tag team now. And then Samu leaving just kind of completely cut off their momentum. Because I think they could have been... You know, we talk about a lot, like, guys like Razor Ramon or Chris Jericho, who once they're on a certain level, doesn't matter how much they lose, they're kind of at that level. And I think the Head Shrinkers, sure. through this title reign, had gotten there. Now they could help put over other teams and help be involved in other feuds and always be, you know, former tag team champion, the Head Shrinkers, and kind of look like top dogs. And I thought that was, you know, Samu leaving kind of took that from them.
Graham, reaction, what did you think was the ceiling for the Head Shrinkers? And also, what did you think of this match?
I dug them as baby faces. I think certainly the division needed that at that point, because with the Steiners gone, what do you have left?
Mm.
And so they had built up such credibility as heels. I mean, they had torn through, they basically broke up the Natural Disasters. They dealt with the Smoking Guns for the better part of the year. They had some brawls with the Steiner brothers. And so they already had that credibility there. So you put the belt on them, and it's not so surprising. You turn them babyface, and it's actually a lot more surprising. But I thought that it was a good move for the time. And I remember when this match was announced on paper, you kind of go, "Wow, this is kind of a mismatch."
Mm. Yeah,
because you've got the guy who just like beat Hogan and killed Tatanka and killed the Undertaker, and now he's tagging with Crush, and it was really a tough test for the Head Shrinkers, and the fact that they won really cements them.
Yep.
And it was one of my favorite matches on the show.
I mean, it definitely seemed like they were setting up for a title change, because they needed to give Yoko like something to do after losing the world title. Like at the time, that's what I thought was happening. What do you guys think about?
Go ahead, JR.
Well, I might be stealing one of your talking points, but what do we think about Luger not even being on the show? you know, losing the qualifying round or whatever, double count on the qualifying round, and just comes out here and, you know, continuing his issue with Crush. But I mean, just what a precipitous fall for yep. Luger to not even be on the show.
To me, even as like a 12-year-old kid, it was like the beginnings forming of my kind of smart Mark personality, being like, oh, he's in the doghouse. Like, I felt like even as a kid, you could tell, like, wow, they're really not behind this guy when he doesn't even get a match on King of the Ring, which is a show with, you know, a ton of matches.
Right.
There's clearly a place for him on this. Yeah, Graham, what did you think of Lex Luger's fall from grace?
I didn't think of it that he was in the doghouse. And I was not like a Lex Express guy, but he was being used so oddly at this point that I was a lot more sympathetic toward him. I didn't want him to win the world title at WrestleMania, but I think him being in the tournament on this show would have given the tournament a little bit more credibility.
Put him right in Mabel's slot. I mean, even if you have Bigelow go over him in the first round, at least Bigelow's a believable heel. You know, maybe Crush costs Luger the match.
That's just, you read my mind.
Yeah,
Crush and him trade distractions.
It's
interesting here because I see the comparison to, I don't know if, I'm sure someone has used this comparison already, but Luger's not completely unlike Roman Reigns of 2014, the anointed guy who just kind of doesn't make it there. The difference is you look at how quickly they kind of, well, not quickly, but how, like JR said, just intensely they gave up on Luger. Well, whereas with Reigns, we're seeing the rehab process. It's like, if this were today with a guy like Luger, if he had come up like this, you feel like they would have made the attempt. This would have been his rehab show. Well, this would have been like maybe bring him all the way to the finals and show what he can do.
Well, the difference is they went with the Daniel Bryan of 94 instead.
Right.
And they didn't it in 2015. Right, because it was like the same scenario. I mean,
absolutely. You know,
the fans wanted Brett. They were pushing Luger, and they both were in the Rumble. And in 94, they ended up going with Brett. And in 2015, they went with Luger. I mean, that's pretty much what they did. I think the difference is Luger now, Roman Reigns is a lot younger with a lot more potential. I think Luger then had a lot of baggage with him by that point.
I think what it tells us is that if there were a steroid trial going on in 2015,
yes,
Jordan Duncan would be a lot happier.
Probably.
No, he wouldn't. He'd never be happy.
No, you're
right. He'd find something else. He's never been on one of these. I gotta get him on one of these sometimes just so I can hang up on him.
Just so we can listen to it after.
Love you, Jordan. So anyway, as we move on, we are at the finals of the King of the Ring tournament. A year after his brother claimed the crown, Owen Hart's in there in the finals. He's against Razor Ramon. Credible match for Owen. I mean, you had him go over to Tatanka, who, like we said, was a big enough deal. Really make you hate him by taking out 1-2-3 Kid. But Razor, I mean, Razor was a guy who it seemed like, especially the fact that they took the IC belt off him, this would be a place for him to become King of the Ring, take his next steps, maybe get into the world title picture. This match only goes 6.5 minutes, and the end comes as a result of Jim Neidhart coming back out and the announcer selling it as, oh, he must be coming out to, you know, check on Razor, make sure Razor's okay because he was injured. But no, Neidhart turns on him, helps his old new foundation partner. Owen gets the win and becomes King of the Ring. Now, there's a few things to talk about here. There is talking about, you know, was Razor the prohibitive favorite? And also, does the Neidhart thing hurt or help Owen? Graham, I want to go to you first, and I want to talk about the second topic. How do you think Jim Neidhart getting involved contributed to Owen? Did it help build him up, give him more of a backstory, or was it kind of like, oh, well, why did he need Neidhart's help to win? We were just talking about earlier tonight how he's a guy who finds ways to win, but here he needs someone else's help to win.
I think it does both. It gives the backstory, which is Jim wasn't a Brett guy either, and he was the one that was poisoning Owen's mind. And so he does that. And then on the other hand, you said Owen finds a way to win. Owen found a way to win. he may not have needed it because he beat Tatanka clean. He beat the 1-2-3 Kid clean. And then this other thing happened, but he won anyway, so who cares?
Yeah. Jar, as a kid watching this, did you think Razor was the guy to win the tournament? I feel like I've heard a lot of people say they expected Razor to kind of walk through this, particularly because a babyface had won the year before. In retrospect, we're all looking back and it's obviously like, oh yeah, they're building up Owen as Brett's challenger, so he's going to do all the same stuff. But at the time, did you think Razor had a better shot?
Before the show, I definitely did, because I figured, yeah, like I said, it was going to be Jarrett. I thought it would be Razor going over Jarrett in the final.
Oh, interesting.
Even in the show, I still kind of thought he was going to win. And I mean, like you said, I don't know what we were thinking. I mean, it's so obvious now looking back. It's like one of the most obvious things ever. And I like the Anvil. I'm with Graham. I like the Anvil stuff. And it plays into, you know, we keep talking about Owen kind of recreating Brett's run. Well, he takes his old tag partner as well. You know, that's part of it too. And I like that Owen, since he's been the black sheep of the family, now he has a running buddy. He has the evil, you know, in-law or whatever that's helping him out. And that's even more apparent at SummerSlam when Anvil's in the crowd with all the rest of the family that's cheering on Brett, and he's just skulking in the background, you know, the only guy rooting for Owen. So I liked it. I think Owen needed that bully, that running buddy, to have his back, because he's in this fight with his whole family. He needs the other guy that's kind of the black sheep of the family.
Yeah.
And the match was fine. It didn't really matter, because the whole thing was about the...
It was a story. It was an angle. The match didn't need to be good here.
And I love Savage just flipping out after. I mean, just going crazy. And he's like, you can see him trying to figure out what the hell happened. And he's like piecing it together as they're talking at ringside. He's like, so wait a minute. So when Anvil came out early to help out Bret Hart, them, you know, so he's like kind of piecing it all together as he's going and just completely ignoring Art Donovan. Art's staring at his monitor. Savage completely has his back to him as he's like yelling at Gorilla about what just happened.
I think you're Randy Savage might be from Queens.
You know, my throat is just hurting right now. I'm sorry. I usually have a much better Savage.
I love that Savage is kind of, because I think this show, all throughout the show, it takes a little work from the commentary. It takes a little work from the commentary team to kind of help tell the story.
Oh yeah.
And so I think if you're in the crowd watching, you might not get everything that's happening up until Owen and Anvil take the mic and cut the little promo and everything, right. It might make more sense. But Savage just says, I think that happened so that Brett wouldn't lose the title, so he would lose it to Owen. Now it all makes sense.
It all makes sense, Graham Cawthon.
Glad you got your redemption there. He definitely moved back to Sarasota there. The only thing I didn't love, you brought it up, Grant. I wasn't even thinking about it until you mentioned it, but I totally forgot. I didn't like the whole thing that they said, like, Neidhart had to poison Owen's mind.
Yeah.
Just because, for me, I was like, Neidhart's not, he's not a master manipulator. He's not a planner. He's the Anvil.
They definitely, so they tried to make him that between here and SummerSlam. I feel like by the fall, that's kind of gone. But for these couple of months, they definitely try to make it like, and I don't know if it's, they just didn't trust Owen or what.
Yeah.
But they definitely did try and make it like Neidhart was the guy behind it, and he had poisoned Owen the whole time, and that he wanted revenge on Brett, because, Graham, the fall house shows, right, were all Brett and Neidhart, right? Wasn't that the transition of the feud?
Yeah, but and if you remember Survivor Series, the match graphics of the Teamsters, the picture is Neidhart whispering in Owen's ear.
Right.
Yep.
Which is a perfect playoff of all that.
Yeah. And another interesting thing is by the next year, by the time Neidhart left the company, they actually kind of retconned it, to use a comic book term. I remember when Lawler went full bore back into his feud with Brett, they kind of played it off like, actually, Lawler was the one who was poisoning him, which fit much more to me, because I was like, yeah, Lawler is the type of guy who would get in your ear and kind of do that. But it was interesting how they would just kind of throw that around. They're like, all right, well, whoever's feuding with Brett, he was the guy who turned Owen against him. Like, it would have been great if, like, they carried all the way to 96 and they're like, yeah, Shawn Michaels a couple years ago was...
I was going to go with Hakushi.
Yeah.
Yes.
This Hakushi guy used to be Owen's Japanese pen pal. And
by the way, the coronation is great too. And another thing that makes it screamingly obvious that Owen was going to be the guy to win, King of Hearts as the nickname is so perfect.
So perfect. One of the best nicknames of all time.
And I love how he refuses to let Jack Tunney give the cape and crown and demands that Neidhart gets to do it. And then that's when Savage, the light bulb goes off, is when they're doing the coronation. But I thought the coronation was fantastic. I think it's the best. I mean, you know, obviously discounting Austin 316. But I think other than that, it's like as a pure coronation, it's the best they had was Owen, just in all his glory. I mean, that's the, you know, that's the shot everyone remembers about Owen and his career and his life, is him on the throne with a big smile on his face, with the big goofy crown on his head and the cape and all that. Just like the perfect Owen shot, just goofy and great and heelish all at once.
It's a great moment. It's a great moment we'll talk a little bit more about. But before we can take a break, we cannot gloss over this 12.5-minute match, probably about 30 with the introductions and the pre-videos and everything else. On this new generation show, Roddy Piper, who is probably in the best shape of his life, to be fair, looking jacked and cut, taking on Jerry Lawler. Lawler had lured...
Piper was ridiculous.
He was ripped, man. He was... Lawler had lured Piper out of retirement, just mocking him, making fun of this sick kid. I'm not going to rehash the whole feud, but the bottom line is that Roddy Piper and Jerry Lawler end up closing out the show. Piper, of course, gets the win, because even when he was a heel, you know, Piper would generally get the win. But, yeah, it's an old school. I mean, I'm not a guy who watched a lot of old school Memphis wrestling, so you guys can educate me, but I'm assuming this was pretty much an old school Memphis, just kind of smoke and mirrors, a lot of crazy brawling. I want to get into the, you know, getting into the meat of this show, and we'll talk more about this, but just quick impressions of the match. Graham, starting with you.
I think Piper is great. I think he's 1980s Piper. And I think Lawler is cartoony WWF heel Lawler, and that's just a bad mesh.
So
if it was a straight up brawl, it'd be fun.
If we had Memphis Lawler, you think this would actually been potentially a match that people remember really fondly?
If it was not goofy heel Lawler, it would have been fun. Right.
Yeah. JR, similar thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. And the stuff with the kid at ringside is what really kills it. Yep. And there's no reason to care about this kid. Yeah, Lawler humiliated him on the King's Court, made him beg and do all the Piper stuff. But, like, also we're supposed to really give a shit about this kid's feelings. I don't know. It felt so forced into it, and it dominates the match. Like, Lawler's constantly obsessed with going to get him. And it pays off a bit, because that's how he finally turns the tide on Piper, is that, you know, Piper goes to defend him, and he, you know, he gets, finally Lawler gets a shot in at him. But, yeah, I agree. I thought Piper was great. I thought he looked great. Mm-hmm. They just didn't click, and I think this is a match that on paper it's fine that it happened, and they really pushed it. Remember, the show was on Father's Day, and it was kind of like a throwback, so it's fine to say this is the new generation, but we're gonna have this kind of throwback match for all the dads out there. But put it in the middle of the show. Like, this screams right. Middle of the show match. And I know they probably didn't want to end with a heel, which, you know, would have been either the Diesel thing couldn't have gone last, right? Because they had to set up the anvil. But I would have just ended it with Owen winning the crown. I mean, they ended with Brett a year earlier, ended with Owen this year, and that's it. And have this a little bit earlier in the show. And you could still have the Diesel stuff set up Owen. But this just ends the show on kind of just a blah note. And again, I mean, it's not awful. It's just, I don't know.
Bad. Flat.
Yeah, flat.
It's definitely a change of pace from what it felt like they were trying to go for the whole show, kind of showing off.
It was a fast-paced young guys, and now 12 minutes is just a bit too long for these guys.
Yeah, basically being able to show off, like, look at what we have, and, you know, I'll talk more about the new generation. We set up a lot of points here. We're going to go into a break. I will give credit where credit's due. I thought the kid did a decent Piper impression. Can we agree?
Yeah, but it should have ended on Raw. And like, this should be he didn't need to be all over this match.
Yeah,
I'm sure you got a good paid for it.
I'm just trying to say something nice, you know. I'm just trying to wrestle with optimism.
Why couldn't his power have gone out?
Oh, guys, we had a good discussion of the card. We've run it down. Hope you guys are enjoying listening so far. When we come back, we will dig a little deeper on some of the things we've already discussed. You are listening to PTBN Rewind. I am Ben Morse. Take a gander at some of the other great podcasts we have for you here on Place to Be Nation, and we will be back with our second half talking about King of the Ring 1994.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com, The Kevin Kelly Show. Every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Place to Be Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and placetobenation.com. You can check out myself and Scott Criscolo on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, home of great interviews and our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. If you need your fix of current wrestling talk, we have plenty of options for you there, including Main Events, which features roundtable discussion led by PTBN analysts and special guests, our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, including immediate feedback and discussion for WWE, NXT, Ring of Honor, and New Japan Super Shows, and Wrestling with Optimism, which focuses on the positives of the business. Also, be sure to relive wrestling's past with Graham Cawthon's excellent exclusive History of Wrestling podcast, Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave's Wrestling Culture podcast, our monthly pay-per-view rewind roundtable series led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance podcast starring myself and Pro Wrestling Only's Will, diving into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. Sports fans have plenty to dive into as well. We feature The Extra Point with Scott Criscolo and Dr. G, The Kings of Sport featuring Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, The Sports Sound hosted by Cowboy and Cowboy Sr., as well as the NBA Team Podcast, which takes a year-round deep dive into pro hoops. PTBN also proudly features Richard and the Mailman podcast, which specializes in the world of TV, thought leadership, anger, and irreverence. As mentioned, all these shows are available on PlacetoBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. PTBN is also home to the tremendous in-depth features on pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments, and more. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island in Fall River, Massachusetts, Scott Keats, RSPWFAQ.com blog, and Piledriver.net.
The Place to Be Nation and Pro Wrestling Only are proud to present the PWO-PTBN Podcast Network. Join us for a variety of great shows that explore all the facets of professional wrestling.
Join good old Will from Texas for our Place to Be Nation reaction shows and Goodwill Wrestling, which has been kicking since before JR had barbecue sauce.
Listen to Where the Big Boys Play and join Chad and Parv as they discuss classic NWA and WCW pay-per-views.
And take in one of our newest podcasts, Exile on Bed Street, and allow Chris Zellner to give you a history lesson about important moments in wrestling's colorful past.
Listen to Johnny, Pete, Parv, and Kelly, the titans of wrestling, as they examine in depth the history of the WWF in the 1970s and 1980s.
And then there's Brainbuster, the wrestling game show, Tag Teams Back Again, the Pro Wrestling Super Show, the All Japan Excite Series, and the Super Extreme Vault for some ECW.
You can hear all of these great podcasts and more on one feed. Remember, PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network, part of the Place to Be Nation family.
Hey guys, welcome back. Hopefully you will check out some of those other great Place to Be Nation podcasts, but right now you are listening to PTBN Rewind. My name is Ben Morris. I am joined by Justin Rosero and Graham Cawthon. We're talking about King of the Ring 1994. Want to quickly take a break from that to discuss the fact that obviously when you guys are listening to this, it's not going to be too far removed from the passing of the American Dream, Dusty Rhodes. Took a lot of us by surprise this week. If you haven't already, go and listen to Graham's episode of History of Wrestling this week. Him, Brad, and Dan do a great recap of Dusty's career and really just kind of a free-flowing talk piece about what made Dusty Dusty and just a lot of great stuff. I'm sure we'll have a lot of other great tribute material both on Place to Be Nation and on the podcast throughout the week. But Justin, because I know you're not going to get another chance to be on the air until Kevin Kelly next week, I wanted to give you a quick chance to, you know, give your thoughts on Dusty. I know he was one of your favorites, and kind of, you know, say your piece, and I want to do the same as well.
I think my Dusty Rhodes is just a little bit better than my Randy Savage Ben Moss.
Absolutely.
But the also Exile on Bad Street, Chris Zellner, they did a retrospective as well. Jason Greenhouse has a piece up that has clips of Dusty's best promo work as well. Chad did an awesome kind of quick write-up of his memories and thoughts of Dusty as a performer.
Within hours of the event, it was pretty impressive.
Right, and he's one of his favorites. So, it really surprised me. Caught me off guard when I first saw. I think it was on like Scott Keith's blog. Someone just put RIP Dusty, and I'm like, oh, I hope it's not what I think it is. And then I looked on Twitter, and there it was. A guy that I always loved. Right when I started watching, he was really at the peak of the polka dots. So I kind of got into him then. Of course, you know, he had his moments there with all the Sapphire stuff, and, you know, we're all still looking for in SummerSlam. But, you know, going back as I grow as a fan and rewatching some of his stuff and his best promo work, obviously the, my favorite is the one in 1994 when he asked Dustin to be his partner. One of the most emotional promos you'll ever watch, and that leads into the great thing where they go to the bar and recruit the Nasty Boys. Dusty walks into the bar with the big, like, denim baggy shirt on, and then the awesome War Games match that they have that he's involved in. Just a nice throwback. And, you know, my first real, you know, after his run in WWF, you know, was him as a commentator in WCW, because he was so good for so long in that role, just so much nonsense in such a great way, and just a guy that was superbly entertaining. And I'm not even giving him, you know, any credit right now for his awesome in-ring career from, you know, the span, the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, all his stuff in Florida, all his stuff in Crockett. People more well-versed in it than me have already said much more than I could, but just one of the true legends of the sport. He'll be missed. It sounds like, you know, he's doing, or he was doing, fantastic work with the NXT crew as well down at the Performance Center. It sounds like that's going to be a big gaping hole for them as well down there. And one of my favorite tweets I saw was from Justin Henry, a friend of the site. And he said, to, you know, just as a signal of what the span of things that Dusty Rhodes had an influence on, he helped create War Games and he helped create Bray Wyatt. So, I mean, that shows you the span and length that he had in his career of how influential he was to create those two things, like 30 years apart or whatever. Was just really cool. And just a tough loss for the company. I'm looking forward. They're going to do a special for him Monday night after Raw on the network. There's plenty of Dusty footage on the network. There's plenty on YouTube. I suggest you spend some hours of your weekend maybe kind of reliving that, paying tribute to the man. And I feel like the guy got you know, all the coverage and all the love he deserved after passing. I mean, he was on Fox News, you know, Sky Sports, like everything. He was all over the place. This is, you know, even on the local sports talk radio, they were putting it as part of their headlines on the top of every, you know, 20 minutes or whatever. So I thought it was really cool to see him get that much, you know, reverence, and you didn't see anything bad about him. Just a really great guy. And just one quick anecdote. When Scott and I went to Armageddon 2005 in Providence, after the show, there's this little section. I don't know if it's even there anymore, and they redesigned the dunk. It might have gone away now. But there was a section where everyone, where all the cars are parked, where all the guys, and they'd go in and get in the cars. And other than Simon Dean pretending to slip on ice and taking pratfalls for everyone, Dusty and DiBiase walked out together, and they had the 12-pack, and they were chilling in the back of in the back of an SUV with the trunk open, just knocking back some beers and, you know, saying hi to the fans. And then they just threw the 12-pack in the car and took off. So, like, just imagining what it's like to be in that car on the ride home would have been so awesome. So just one of the few times, the only time I think I was ever really up and close to Dusty Rhodes. But a legendary guy, like I said, others will say more, but a guy that I'll definitely miss. Just, I always loved knowing that he was around to maybe pop up here and there, and I was glad he did get to a bunch of times with the Suns over the last couple of years of Raw.
Yeah, very well put. Very well put. I'm not going to go into it too much because I would basically be reiterating everything you said, Justin. But yeah, a guy I liked as a kid, and ended up loving as an adult. I think he's a guy you really need to go back and, you know, appreciate the breadth and span of everything he did to truly appreciate him. I got to meet him too, WrestleMania 30 a couple of years ago. I got to interview him for Marvel, and on a weekend of highlights where we got to talk to a lot of people and have a lot of cool memories. That was honestly one of the tops for me. Just a cool guy, and I agree what you said at the end. It was kind of reassuring knowing he was out there. And I think this one hit hard because a lot of the wrestler deaths that happen that are sudden, they're jarring. But right. With Dusty, I think we got so used to having him around as an elder statesman, mm-hmm. that it's one of those, like, it's almost like your grandfather. It's like, oh man, it's just sad he's not going to be there anymore.
And I think so, I thought he was older than he was. Like, when I learned he was only 69, did. I was surprised. Yeah. I just figured when I read it, I'm like, well, he wasn't looking great. You know, he's probably like in his late 70s. I kind of get it. You know, was on the road a lot. And then when he said he was 69, I'm like, man, we should have had at least another 10 years with this guy, you know?
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, like we said, plenty of tributes going to be paid for Dusty Rhodes. It's all deserved. Thoughts to Dustin and Cody and his wife and his family. And, you know, we're gonna pay our respects by continuing to talk about the business that he devoted everything to and that he loved so much, and that's professional wrestling. In this case, it is King of the Ring 1994. Boys, we've danced around it long enough. We have to talk about the commentary on this show, for good and for ill, because I think it's both sides of the coin. It's a legendary show, commentary-wise, thanks to mostly one man. You've been hearing him throughout the evening. Art Donovan, former football legend, who I have no idea who brought him in. I don't know why they brought him in. Well, Graham, do you have any insight on this, or Justin? Anyone?
From talking with a few folks that were either at the show or were Baltimore natives for the book, he was kind of a local celebrity. And to some degree, all of the Baltimore Colts, as they used to be, were celebrities around town, the guys that you would go out to dinner and you would occasionally bump into one. And he was a personality that you would sometimes see on the local news. And I don't think necessarily what you saw on the local television in Baltimore was much different than what we were blessed with on commentary. I think that you pretty much got him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think whoever set this up, I think whoever set it up was of the mindset of, we've kind of ignored Baltimore for a good long time, and they had, and they really had. And so we're bringing a pay-per-view here. Vince has to have neck surgery. He's going to miss the show. Would it be beneficial to bring this local celebrity on and kind of, you know, bridge that relationship a little bit, that we've kind of ignored them in lieu of DC or in lieu of the Capitol Center for, geez, probably since 88 or 89. I think that maybe was the mindset.
And as a, you know, someone who spent some time working alongside the NFL Network, saw his share of NFL films, Art was a mainstay on those like yearbooks and all the NFL film specials. And exactly like Graham said, that was what he was like. So when I saw those for hours on end working there, that was like, I was like, oh, okay, this is him. Like he says the same goofy kind of spaced out stuff. Like, I think that's just his shtick. That's just who he is. And, you know, it's jarring to us because we're so into commentary, especially at that time, being such a big driver of the show. The fact that they'd roll the dice by having this guy out there was surprising. And we hadn't really seen that since, what, like WrestleMania 2? You know, I mean, I guess maybe a couple times with Bob Uecker or whatever, but even he kind of knew what the hell he was talking about. I mean, this is like the first time since like Susan St. James, you know, where we have like a real, this novice goof in the booth. And, you know, overall, I thought Gorilla was off on this evening. Like, I thought, you know, and he hadn't even really been, it's not like they dragged him out of mothballs. I mean, he had been around still doing TV. He was doing the radio stuff. He even called a match at Survivor Series and the Rumble on pay-per-view. But I thought he was completely, he just felt lost and out of touch on the show. And I thought Randy Savage was a juggernaut. I thought this was his best ever commentary performance. And it's been kind of cool rewatching a lot of these shows and these Raws that we've been doing. And seeing him kind of grow as an announcer, like from where he came at WrestleMania 9 to here, is just leaps and bounds. And I thought he completely carried the show on his back. I thought he threaded all the storylines. I thought he got over across all the points. And he was really the guy. He seemed like the only guy who knew what he was talking about at all times. Like anytime either the other guy screwed something up, he was there to correct them and push the storyline along, because he knew exactly what was going on in the company. He knew the exact agenda. And if you told me that like Vince was in his ear from his hospital room, I would have believed you, because that's how in touch with the product he seemed at that point. He seemed like the perfect ambassador and the perfect mind for what was going on in the company, because he just nailed everything in this show.
Yeah, 100%, Justin. You and I have talked, we talked as we were prepping for this show, about all the points you just made. And I think the really pertinent ones to me were, one, Savage is amazing on this show. I mean, it's kind of the thing where it's like he's so good in the ring that when he wanted to continue wrestling in 94 and beyond, and, you know, his parting of the ways with WWF and all that, you kind of can't fault him, because he still had a couple good years left. He had a couple good in-ring years in WCW. But the way he takes to commentary, like a true pro, and really, I think, even shines more here than he did on those episodes of Raw, because he has to.
Right.
Because Vince isn't there to kind of pick up some of the slack. It's really, you know, Savage is a big game player. When he has to step up, be the lead announcer, which he was here, he does it. And he's incredible. And to your point about Gorilla, yeah, I think Gorilla had a terrible night. And when you and I were balancing it back and forth, we were kind of trying to figure out reasoning, because his son had not passed at this point. So he was still in the game at that. And the best I could tell was just that Gorilla works best when he can be the overwhelming babyface commentator and has a heel like a Jesse or a Bobby to play off of. Here, he's got Savage, who's a bigger babyface than he is, and Art Donovan, who he has no patience with whatsoever.
Maybe, but I mean, when Gorilla was with Piper, I feel like he wasn't like this, though. And Piper, to me, is on the level of Savage. I just don't know. I don't know if he was just completely, again, disenfranchised with the product, which is what you hear.
Checked out. Yeah.
He was just kind of done. He didn't like the way it was going anyway. Or maybe he just had a bad night. I don't know. But he definitely seems out of it. He definitely seems a bit lost. And I thought, yeah, Savage was just completely the glue in the show. And in an ideal world, he goes to WCW, retires in like 99, right before
his body
came out, and then broke down and gave out. And then, he comes back in like 99, 2000 and becomes a full-time in the booth. Like, that would have been, like, you know, ideal, would have been awesome if that happened.
Not only that, could have spared us a few years of really played out Lawler.
Right.
Maybe Lawler moves out of the booth sooner. That would have been a great combo, JR and Savage through the Attitude Era. Mm-hmm. Can you think of that? Man, would have been a dream. I think for me with Art was, maybe it's because I was so laser focused going in because I knew we were going to talk about this, but I didn't find him that bad. I didn't find him as bad as I thought. And part of that, I think, is because I've been desensitized because I've heard the clips so many times.
Well, he doesn't talk
a lot. It's like you almost know it's coming. He really doesn't. That's the thing, is I think the perception is that, oh, man, he just keeps, it's this old man rambling throughout the whole show. But no, he just, he chimes in maybe three times a match, and it's more, I think you get more, you more feel Gorilla's annoyance with him than you do with his performance itself.
Right. I mean, I think by the end, I don't know if it was the finals or the main event. There's one match where he doesn't even talk like the whole time. Yeah. He's just like,
I think
gone.
It's the finals.
Yeah.
Well, that was right after he predicts Razor Ramon the entire show, and then once Razor makes it to the finals, immediately hedges his bet. Graham, did you have something you were going to say?
Well, I just love that in the opening moments of the first match, he goes, I can't even stand to watch it.
Yeah.
Like, way to put over the product.
No, I don't think that's what he meant, but yeah.
Yeah, it sums it up pretty nicely.
I think he just meant because it's brutal. I don't know if you're being facetious, Greg, but I think he meant it more than
That's literally what he says during the opening moments of Razor and Bam Bam. Because,
I just think he meant because they're beating each other up so much he has to walk away.
No. That's exactly what he meant. Yeah. That's exactly what he meant. But I just love the opening of opening moments of the first match, I can't even stand to watch it. Is this what you guys used to do? Did you guys used to do that?
Right. At least have an idea.
Art Donovan, we thank you for the memories, and certainly a fascinating show on commentary. Just an interesting one to listen to all those points, and to think what could have been with that Savage one. Moving on to talk about Owen Hart for a little bit. We talked about him a lot in the first half. I want to kind of put a bow on it. I touched on it, the fact that Owen at this point really is not that far removed from being just Bret Hart's little brother. 1993, a year earlier, he was not even thought of. If he had been left off a pay-per-view, you wouldn't have noticed. He was left off almost every pay-per-view. His rise over the course of the months leading up to this, from the great turn at Survivor Series to his kicking Bret's leg out from his leg at the Rumble to the amazing match at WrestleMania, the way this guy just strung together, and basically it was like, you know, Bret Hart was the guy who Vince did not intend to be champion, but once he was forced to make Bret Hart champion, it almost became, well, we don't have a rival for him, and Owen Hart just almost arrived, like, fully formed out of nowhere. How important was this night to him to really, like, say, okay, he got the fluke win over Bret, or the hard-fought win over Bret at Mania, but for him to be a sustained main eventer, not just while Bret Hart's champion, how important was King of the Ring 94, Justin, in terms of establishing Owen Hart as a guy who can hang around beyond his initial angle and feud?
Yeah, it was definitely necessary. I mean, I think his win over Bret was enough to at least get him a title match, but this kind of props him up as being a guy that is up on that level, because Bret had won King of the Ring the year before. Owen does it here, and he has a pretty tough run. He doesn't get a bye or anything like that, so yeah, I think it was important. And going back to your point about how he kind of comes out of nowhere, Graham, I don't know, have you ever read anywhere or confirmed you know, the rumor that's always been around, and I don't know if it's because it came from this guy himself, was that Bruce was originally pegged for that whole angle, not Owen. I mean, I don't know if I buy that. I don't know if that was something Bruce floated, you know, because he's a little bit delusional. But, you know, Bruce certainly seemed suited to be a heel. I'm glad they went with Owen, obviously. But I feel like if it was Bruce, it would have been like kind of a one and done kind of thing. But, yeah, I think this was instrumental in keeping him kind of simmering. I mean, they could have just, you know, they could have just done Brett Owen here if they wanted to. And if they weren't interested in making Owen a sustained high-level heel, they could have just blown it off here. Brett beats him, and then he's done. But instead, they decided to make him the king. And, you know, it's good, too, because it gives him a gimmick to live off of for, like, the next 3 years. I mean, this King of Hearts lasts for a long time, so.
Yeah. Graham, does Owen earn his spot here with his performances, in particular with what Justin was talking about before we went to the break, that incredible, just that moment of sinking back in the crown, cocky smile on his face, and just giving that great promo at the end. Does Owen prove to you here that he deserves to be at the level he's at?
He proves that he's a threat.
Mm-hmm.
I think at WrestleMania, what we get off of that is, and what Justin went to as a fan, you get that immediate Brett Owen rematch. Mm-hmm. Well, Brett won the title. Owen beat him at Mania. It makes sense. That's what we're going to do. It's the house show run, and you're going to buy a ticket because Owen did it once. Can he do it again? And that's the entirety of the story. And so at this show, it shows that Owen did it once with Brett. But then he also beat Tatanka. Then he also beat Owen, 1-2-3 Kid. And then he also beat Razor Ramon. And, like, who is left of that upper mid-card variety that he hasn't proven himself against? So, yeah, he's the logical top guy to be chasing Brett for the world title now.
Talking about Brett, we spoke about what great chemistry he and Diesel have. Digging a little deeper on that. What is it about the Brett Diesel dynamic? Because Diesel, Kevin Nash, is a guy who he's got his strengths and he's got his weaknesses. With some guys, he has surprisingly really good matches. With some guys, he's a guy who needs to be carried, and he's admitted as much. He's a guy who's not shy about that. Shawn Michaels is a guy who obviously he works well with. He's comfortable with. Him and Scott Hall know each other. Outside of the Click guys, though, Brett could arguably be his greatest opponent. I think it's a coin flip on him and Sean. What is it about Bret Hart and how he works with Diesel Graham that you think makes these guys such natural opponents?
Well, I think Brett is between Brett and Sean.
Mm-hmm.
I think Brett is one that can brawl with Diesel and trade shots and I don't really see Sean as that guy. Sean would do more of the high flying stuff. Brett is more mat based, but I think the Brett offense, working the legs, setting up for the sharpshooter, is a good foil for Diesel. And Brett's a small guy, so just his selling works with working against bigger guys. He usually works against bigger guys anyway, and that's I don't know. Those are just words that I strung together in response to your question.
It's fair. It's very late at night, and I thought it was fairly coherent. Justin, is to go back to the point I just made, is Bret Hart Diesel's best opponent?
I mean, he's probably tied with Sean. I'd probably put them even. And I think part of it what helps is that both Brett and Sean are guys that are such perfectionists in the ring that when they're on, it's hard for the other guy not to be, and they kind of don't allow their opponent to be lazy. You know what I mean?
Right.
So
it's an ego thing, too.
Unless it's a period where Brett's checked out, like their cage match at In Your House 6 where Brett's kind of just burnt out and going through the motions, you know, it's not a surprise that that's the match that's the worst of the four. Every other time, Brett had some level of motivation and was, you know, working hard, and Diesel kept up with him, or Nash kept up with him. So, I mean, I think, you know, all the stuff Graham said is 100% accurate, the way, you know, the match pacing goes, that Brett's a smaller guy, and it makes sense that he worked the legs, and Brett's such a good storyteller. that he could work around. Like, I think in this match, you know, Diesel holds his own, but Brett works around him a lot of the time. You know, he's the one that's, you know, he gets a lot of offense in, even though he's the face in this match. He makes a lot of comebacks, and that helps things keep on pace and keep time. And Diesel just lands the big blows. And Brett was really good, too, with his striking, with his punches and stuff. So it's like that plays a role in a lot of these Diesel matches, too. There's a lot of times where they go toe-to-toe and they're trading fists. And even though Brett's punching up and Diesel's punching down, they're even because Brett throws such good punches and he sells so well. So I think that all comes together to a nice package of Brett pushes Diesel to you know, to his limit, to be as good as he can. And, you know, this is a time period, too, where Nash was working for that money. I mean, you can say what you want about his WCW stuff. He was cashing the checks that were already, you know, locked in. But here, his career was almost over in January. You know, he's right. Lucky to be where he is. So he's definitely, during these initial matches with Brett, busting his ass to make sure he can stay at this level and start making some money.
I second all that. Those are words that I said in my head but didn't come out of my mouth.
That's why I'm here for you, Graham.
Yeah.
Justin, you just did a whole podcast on basically looking at King of the Ring tournaments and rebooking and what would you have done here differently. As far as 1994, rehashing what you said, or if you've had new thoughts since rewatching the show, if Owen doesn't win here, who else can benefit from winning this tournament, whether it's someone who's on the card here or someone who didn't make it to the show?
Quang. No, but I think either Razor... I think Razor would have been the next logical guy just to set him up for the rematch with Diesel, or maybe Bigelow to get rebuilt from the Doink feud. I think outside of those three, I mean, unless you want to super push Jarrett or something like that.
I was going to say, would Jarrett be a pick there?
I don't think he was ready yet. He could have maybe made the finals, and that would have got him going, like Bigelow the year before. But I just don't think he was, I don't think he would have been overly believable as the king. I think Razor or Bigelow would have been the only two real alternatives here.
Graham, make the case for King IRS.
You could sell a lot of IRS water bottles.
Suck cups.
Suck cups, baby. Ultimate Warrior. You can put milk, juice, whatever you want.
King IRS, maybe they could have done something since the corporation was starting. I guess maybe they could have.
It would have been interesting just to see how he would have incorporated the look into his look already. Like, he just, and actually, to flash forward, he years later on Raw, didn't he steal Lawler's crown? You know that weird angle they did when the A-Team was hosting the show? This is a bizarre memory I'm having. There was
no recollection.
I don't know. 2009 through 2015 is one. All right, mishmash blur.
Go back and watch. Whenever the A-Team movie came out, they were the guest hosts, and IRS. I swear to you, IRS stole Lawler's crown and wore him around, and now I know what King IRS would have been like.
I'd prefer if he had all that stuff in his briefcase somehow.
Yeah,
the cape, the crown, the scepter. Somehow he fit it all in the briefcase.
Takes it out after the match. Yeah. Graham, who would you have gone with if not Owen?
Well, it's not so much who would I go on with without Owen. It's just the structure of the tournament in 94 compared to 93. I think in 93, it's the focal point. Mm-hmm. They've got former world champions in there. They've got two undefeated guys. They've got it's just built up to be this end all be all event.
Sure.
In 94. There's the tournament. There's the world title match, champion versus champion. There's Roddy Piper and Jerry Lawler. Like, it almost becomes what we have now with Survivor Series, where the elimination match is just one thing, but we're going to give everything to you.
So you don't think Hogan Yoko served that role in 93?
It did, but it was a world title match. How do I put
Here's the question, and not to cut you off, Graham, and like complete your point if you want to, but is that the result of them not emphasizing the tournament, or is it just the depleted roster?
My thought is that 93 was built more around an athletic competition, and 94 was more of a storyline. So, I mean, I think that's the big difference, and maybe that's what you're getting at, Graham. 93 was more about, you know, Bret
Hart
who's the best wrestler, and we get that with Bret Perfect. You know, like, that's the whole, to me, that's the snapshot of the tournament, is them going, you know, whatever, 20 minutes and having this fantastic match, two guys, both faces, a respect match. In 93, it was all about Bret Hart outworking the roster to take, you know, to prove that he's the best, even though he just got screwed at WrestleMania, he wants to still prove he's the best in the company. 94 is this kind of, and I think 94, we talked about this on that podcast, Ben. Mm-hmm. I think 94 is one of the best booked King of the Ring tournaments.
Sure.
That
it's the
done.
Survivor Series 98 of, right. of King of the Rings.
You know, there's some nice twists and turns, and you get a couple good matches. I think it's overlooked a bit because match-wise, it doesn't really match up to 93 because sure. of the short durations and whatnot. But I think it's a really good story throughout this tournament.
Graham, well, do you think... go ahead.
You can have the same story. Keep the same story. But so many of the guys in 94 compared to 93 had not really established themselves yet, had not been in the company very long. Mm. And meanwhile, you've got guys like Luger, like yes. Yoko, like That's Crush, who were on the show. Mm-hmm. But I think they would have added a lot more had they been part of the tournament.
Would they have overshadowed Owen, though, do you think?
That's what I'm wondering. Does it suddenly become, you know, Owen is a bit of an underdog to win this. But in the field, you can at least see him doing it. You can see him beating, you know, the Tatankas and the 1-2-3 kids. Once you have Luger and Yoko in there, does it suddenly become? It becomes an underdog story, which, let's be honest, is a babyface story. Does that detract from Owen's win?
I don't think so, because even look at the way he won. Mm. It was Neidhart's interference,
right?
So you could have had that be Luger. And either way, I think even if you beef up the tournament, it only elevates Owen.
Sure. I mean, yeah, I think the finals, it's the same whether he goes over Luger or Razor. I think he's actually better off going over Razor. He was the more credible guy.
I would agree for sure there. But I think to my point that I was making is if you look a year later to Mabel, right, mm-hmm. and not completely on the same level as Owen at this point, but, you know, it almost hurt him that he had all those other big names in the tournament because it pissed sure. everyone off.
they had to get them out of the way.
Right.
You know?
And you load him in the tournament, and then you have him going out in stupid ways, and then all of a sudden you're left with Mabel, Savio Vega, and the roadie when you had this tournament with these other, you know, kind of good names. So I'm just wondering if that would have hurt Owen to have some of these other guys in there overshadowing. But I think the difference is no one gave as much of a shit about Yoko and Luger as they would a year later about Taker and Shawn. So maybe to Grant's point, it would have been fine. Maybe, whatever, Luger wouldn't have outshone Owen that much because I think his star was already starting to dull either way.
Sure. I mean, you could have put Luger in for Tatanka in the first round. You could have... I don't know what you do with Yoko. Yoko was an interesting case at this point because I actually... It was funny, as having glossed over this, since Yoko wasn't at SummerSlam, I think in my mind I kind of had him out of the picture a lot more than he was in the spring. But he actually feuded with Earthquake, if I remember correctly, briefly.
Yep. And Earthquake Typhoon. Left the company right before this, too.
Yeah.
He was supposed to fight Owen in the qualifier, but he left.
Yeah.
Well, they said he was injured or whatever, but...
So we got Typhoon instead.
No, it was Doink.
No. Typhoon
replaced him in the Yokozuna feud.
Oh, right. But Owen ended up beating Doink in the qualifier instead.
Quake tagged out.
Yeah.
Typhoon returned.
All right, guys, I want to talk about, to kind of start wrapping things up here. As we said, as we alluded to, there's a big push for the new generation here, and it's one of the first time WWF really starts leaning on having a, for lack of a better term, a brand identity. You know, during, I guess you had Rock and Wrestling, but this is the first time they really said, like, okay, this is a new era.
Right.
This is a new era in the WWF. All these old guys, they're gone. They weren't explicitly saying they're in WCW yet, but obviously that's the implication. You know, Hogan's gone, all his buddies are gone, and we've got this great young talent. And then, as we said, they still end the show with Piper Lawler. Two points I want to get to. One, what was the overall message of new generation? What were they trying to accomplish, and do you think they did so? And then I also want to talk about, was it a lack of faith to still put these established guys on last? Graham, since we talked a lot the last time, I want to hear your take first on this, just kind of what you thought the new generation was, both then and looking back now from perspective. Like, what does that mean? What does it mean when they're pushing this new generation?
It's kind of funny to look back now in 1994, and they're showing these clips of, you know, Hogan and Sheik and Volkoff from 10 years earlier to this, like, I don't know, turn of the century kind of music. Mm-hmm. Like, it was 100 years before that all this happened. It was 10 years ago. I think it was just, it was, we're young, we're fresh, we're not what you think of when you think of the WWF. We're not Hulk Hogan, we're not Hulkamania, we are young guys that bounce around the ring. We're the 1-2-3 kid, we're Jeff Jarrett, we're Bret Hart. And as far as Piper Lawler, I think on paper it's fine.
Yeah.
I think to close the show, it's fine. It's kind of like a kind of like Survivor Series 91, where you have Taker and Hogan in the middle of the show, and then you end with kind of a feel good. And I get that on paper. I completely get that. But just and especially with Piper, very much. If you watch the network feed, is the Coliseum video.
The Coliseum video. They have all the behind the scenes stuff. Yeah,
which is really weird. Because they opened the telecast with Monsoon saying the Baltimore Arena was the site.
Yeah,
it was. I'm watching this live. Was, but yeah, there's a backstage promo from Piper exclusively for Coliseum, and he's 1986 Piper. He's
he's
the bad guy that everyone likes. So. That's great. That should be a proven success story right there. I think what kind of clogs it up is one, it's the story as to why they're fighting is a little convoluted. The thing with the quote unquote kid who is probably 20 something is convoluted. And then their styles just don't mesh because Piper's in there just brawling and throwing fists, and Lawler is very much, you know, chicken shit heel. And not in the – he's very much the homogenized WWF chicken shit heel, not the we'll throw a fireball in you Memphis heel. And I just don't think it clicks whatsoever. And the finish is crap. I think if Piper had gone with the sleeper, it would have at least saved that part.
I think part of it too is just it feels a little tone deaf because they're pushing so hard and then they close with this. And even though it's fine, the feel good, it just – regardless of what that match ends up being, even if it was like a 5-star classic, you're still promoting that these guys don't exist anymore, and then you run the main event out there. It's just like it's such a mixed message. But I love Graham's point about the 10 years earlier thing with the old fogey music. That'd be like now if they had a video with, like, you know, it would be like Batista, JBL. Like, think, I mean, 10 years earlier is 2005, right? So, I mean, think
John Cena and Randy Orton.
Yeah, think about all the guys that are still around now. Right. That would be them playing this old fogey music. But I think the reason they did it was that they had to.
Yep.
I mean, they were forced to. All these other guys left, and they were forced to run with these young guys, and they had to, you know, they had two ways they could have gone about it. They could have just played dumb and just kept chugging along, or they decided to embrace it and really sell. Instead of making it look like they were stuck holding the bag with all these young guys, they made it seem like it was a conscious effort to push the young guys. And, you know, the new generation. Of course, you get all the vignettes, the guy dressing up as the stars with the woman who ignores him. That was one of the classic ones. And that was a couple other ones that they really started to push, the new generation ads. And, you know, one guy, too, that kind of becomes more of a focal point in a way, and I don't know, maybe I'm misreading this, but I thought Todd Pettengill all of a sudden went from just being like an interviewer and kind of quiet host of Mania, almost becomes a little bit of the voice of the promotion. I think that was on purpose too, because he was kind of young. He was a DJ on a New York station, and I think they really tried to start using him more, almost to be, you know, whether you think he was or not, to be the hip voice of the new generation.
Justin, bottom line on King of the Ring 94, not only is it whether it's a thumbs up, thumbs down show, but given what they had to accomplish, all the stuff you just went over, kind of, we need to push past this Hogan era that is dying off, and we need to establish guys like Bret Hart. And also, let's keep in mind the fact that this was a depleted WWF where Vince is standing trial for steroids. He cannot go to a lot of his usual guys. The creative is being done by not necessarily Vince for the first time in ever. Is this a successful show? Is this a show that you enjoyed, but also at the time, was it a show that made young Justin think like, okay, WWF's going to be fine?
Yeah, I think so. And then I went through a stretch where I think I underappreciated it. And I don't know if it was an overcorrection to my fandom, my fanboyhood, thinking everything was great for 94. And maybe because on paper, when you look at the matches, it's not as good as the matches in 93. But yeah, I think so. I think they helped make Diesel seem legitimate. I think they gave Owen a big win. I thought it was really good storytelling. I thought the crowd was hot throughout all of it. I mean, I really enjoyed rewatching it recently. I think it's maybe an underrated show. I think a lot of people just remember maybe the boring 12 minutes of Lawler and Piper and overlook the rest of it. But there's a lot of good in there. I mean, you get arguably the best sub-4-minute match of all time on the card.
Absolutely.
And that's a classic in many ways. You get the kind of the camp of Art Donovan. I know if you can't tolerate it, it makes it tough. But again, he really doesn't talk as probably as much as you think he does. And I think it's easily outweighed by how good Savage is. I enjoyed it. I think it's a really good show. I think it holds up. And, you know, on match quality purely, it's a step back from its year before. But I think overall storytelling and enjoyment, it's right there.
Graham, kind of following up on what Justin just said, what are the greatest accomplishments of this show? And at the end of the day, is it one you enjoyed going back and rewatching?
Well, I think one of the better accomplishments, it's one of, I have to share one of my favorite Art Donovan lines, and it's one that no one really talks about because they always gravitate towards the how much does this fill away. But he has this little exchange with Gorilla during Brett and Diesel. And he says, this is in regards to the match, he goes, it's like David and Goliath. And Monsoon goes, like David and Goliath, indeed. We all know what happened in that story. And then Art goes, yeah, he hit him with a rock. And it was like fantastic timing, comedic timing that you would have seen on like a sitcom. But it was just that little conversation right there. If the whole show was as good as that little exchange, that commentary would be legendary for far different reasons.
And I blame Gorilla for that, because I feel like if he embraced Art, I think they could have been really funny in that role. But I feel like if he fed him like he used to with Bobby, like instead he just flat out ignores him. And I feel like if he just embraced it and was like, you know what, I'm going to treat this guy like a dunce Bobby Heenan or something, I think it could have been much more enjoyable if he just played along.
I agree. I think King of the Ring 94 has a lot of moving parts. For what it is as a standalone show, I think from a fan perspective, if I'm going to watch it again, I'm probably thinking it's a show in the middle. Mm-hmm. But if I think of it from a larger perspective as a chapter 3 and a 6-chapter book, then it's great. You know, I was watching it earlier today because I hadn't seen it in a while. And I kind of thought of it from a certain perspective as kind of being Empire Strikes Back, because in the original Star Wars trilogy, because you don't get the happy endings, because essentially the show is over before Piper and Lawler. If you just end the show right there, from a storyline perspective, you get Brett beaten down, you get him being stabbed in the back, you get Razor being double-teamed, and Owen and his new bad guy friend stand tall at the end of the show. But then you get SummerSlam. So it's if you look at it from a broad perspective, it's a good chapter in a book that has several different chapters in it. If you look at it from a singular show, it's maybe a thumbs in the middle.
Well put. Gentlemen, thank you for coming on here late at night. We are definitely pushing the boundaries of probably all our bedtimes. But thanks for staying up late with me and talking about King of the Ring 1994. Graham, one more time, the information on the new book and also where people can enjoy your work outside of this podcast.
They can come to my house and I'll put on a little show. I'm available most days, so just give me a call beforehand. Check out thehistoryofwwe.com, and you can pick up all the books. We have 6 available. Baltimore is the 6th, and we're still putting the final touches on that, but you can pre-order it. But all the previous titles are up there. And if you're not familiar with thehistoryofwwe.com and you have like 6 hours to spare, it's a website that I think you can get lost in pretty quickly.
Absolutely. 100% true. Justin, Where can people follow your quest to have a podcast on every day of the week while also raising a family? And I guess you still have a job, too?
Yeah, hopefully. PlaceToBeNation.com. If not, we'll have more than one podcast a day. PlaceToBeNation.com. You can find everything. Facebook.com/PlaceToBeNation, Place2BNation. And my parting thought, if I can leave you with one thing to remember me by on this show, is that Graham Cawthon, what a cutie.
I think we can all agree to that. Guys, thanks for listening. We will see you again next month on PTBN Rewind. Until then, be kind, rewind, enjoy. We'll see you in July.
Is he dead?